This is Paul Siegel. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live at 1 p.m. Eastern on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and youtube.com/wanderingdms/live. And now, on with the show. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan. Today on Wandering DMs, we're going to review the first add-on to original D&D in 1975, Supplement Number 1, Greyhawk. And we're going to ask the question, how much of that content and changes were boons and how many were mistakes? All that and more today on Wandering DMs.
Hi, everyone. Before we get into Greyhawk, I will remind you, as always, at the end of the show, we will be hosting our After Party Chat. That is a live video chat hosted by Dan and I with all of our patrons. And you can join in by becoming a patron. Just visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. Join at any tier, and you'll get an invite to our private Discord server. Get all signed up and logged in with that by the end of the show. And maybe a few minutes after the show, 10 minutes or so, around 2:10 Eastern, we will be hosting our After Party Chat.
We hope you'll join us. You know, this is one of the, Paul, today's topic is one that was suggested by a viewer a couple weeks back of the show, actually. And the idea there was maybe we should go and have an episode on the D&D supplements and what parts are good that you could take out to improve your game. And we started to think about that. And then we're like, oh, we could easily spend a whole episode on each separate supplement. So today you're getting the Greyhawk supplement. And of course, you know, last year was the 50th anniversary of original D&D. Therefore, this year we're currently celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Greyhawk supplement. So just in time
nice. For
that. Yeah.
Nice. You know, and I have my copy right here.
Oh my God.
Looking at. Tell me a little bit about the history, because I think mine says it is 12th printing. So clearly a bit older than when the 50th anniversary came out.
Yeah, you know, pretty popular. You know, you're ahead of me, Paul. I actually don't have an actual original printing copy, largely because you made a bound edition of everything that I need for original D&D, including Greyhawk in here. So I just look in this book that you made for me, actually. And it's kind of interesting that, you know, original D&D came out in 74, and, you know, we're accustomed to an edition of D&D nowadays lasting about a decade, like about 10 years. And they started printing supplements in 75, made a couple in 76, and that was it. It was three years were the entire life cycle of original D&D as far as publications go. And then they started making the advanced D&D hardcover line starting in 1977. So we're talking about this very, if you think about the time in role-playing games nowadays, 3 years doesn't seem very long, but that was like the entire lifespan of original D&D from start to finish.
That's fascinating. So my copy here says copyright 1976 and then 12th mm-hmm. printing 1979. What I find interesting about that not only is just that, yes, that they went through 12 editions in the course of 3 years, did it originally come out in 76? Or are you telling me maybe it came out in 75? When did this thing actually?
What I'm told is the best research that we have, and partly this comes from our friend John Peterson, is that the first printing came out in March of 1975.
Okay.
And that's what the 1976 was the last update. So they made a couple of changes in the text as of 1976. So I think that's why they have the copyright date on that. And then there was an errata sheet that they incorporated. And after that, they were just reprinting the same thing from 76.
Interesting. I mean, so it took them, you know, a good year after the set came out, right, to get around to making the first supplement. Not bad.
Yeah. Now, and the other thing to point out, of course, is that we all know that the first two supplements, Greyhawk comes out of Gary Gygax's home campaign in the world of Greyhawk. And then the second one is mm-hmm. named Blackmoor after Dave Arneson's home campaign. They have almost no setting information. So if you pick up, if you've never seen this before, and you pick up this Greyhawk supplement, and you think you're going to find some information about the world of Greyhawk and its kingdoms and its personalities, there is literally nothing. There's nothing in either of these books to that extent. What it does have is it has rules modifications that come out of Gary's play in his campaign. It does have a couple new character classes. And then, of course, it actually sets the standard for what you're going to see in a supplement as far as new spells, new monsters, new magic items. That's the vast majority of it. And
I know we're focusing on Greyhawk here, but I thought in Blackmoor there was a little bit more of setting stuff, wasn't there? There's at least an adventure, right?
There is an adventure. Yep, you're right. Yeah. You're totally right about that. In Greyhawk, nothing. I think there's one single piece of art that suggests a particular tricky feature from Castle Greyhawk. And other than that, absolutely nothing. And I think part of the reason why Gary was still running the game, still had active players in the world of Greyhawk and Castle Greyhawk, and didn't want to reveal the secrets.
No spoilers. No spoilers, Gary. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Interesting. I hadn't thought of that. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. Okay. Well, let's discuss what's in there. Maybe actually before we get into it. Like, I find one of the most interesting things to me of this book is just starting on the first page and reading the foreword, because just the expectations, the foreword here written by Gary Gygax in February of 75. It's fascinating to me just kind of like the level of expectation setting that's going on here, right? He says that at first there's a lot of hemming and hawing around, should you buy this book? Right. And he's trying to instruct the reader of like, well, it's really not going to make any sense if you don't own Dungeons and Dragons. So don't accidentally buy just this book. Right. Yeah. And then goes on to encourage like, oh, you should definitely buy the basic set or the Dungeons and Dragons box set and this book because they're great. Right. And if you already own the Dungeons and Dragons set, then buy this booklet right now, he says. Buy it right now, for what is herein adds immeasurably to the existing game.
Yes, right.
And then he goes on to talk about like what is and isn't. And he says fantasy, this is another little bit I love in this, is fantasy being what it is, it appears there will never be an end to the development of fresh ideas. And this booklet is what we hope will be but the first in a long series of periodic supplements to add to your enjoyment of Dungeons and Dragons.
So isn't clearly, that interesting? Because
they were expected to do by it the more end than of 3 years.
Right? By the end of the next year, they were saying, this is the last thing. Tim Kask, who was then editor, said, this is the last supplement you'll ever see from that's marked Dungeons & Dragons. And now we're moving on to a different game system. So things were volatile, right? They were figuring out how to, you know, they still didn't have the name role-playing game at this point. And they were still figuring out how to create the industry of role-playing games and what publishing for that would look like.
Yeah, I think part of what you're seeing in this text here is they're not yet really wrapped their heads around the audience, right? Part of what happened to them, right, is that their audience blew up into something much larger than they ever thought it was going to be.
Right.
And so it made sense to like, well, maybe we should stop adding and adding, and maybe we need to go back and refine the core of what the game is to a larger audience, maybe an audience who isn't full of medieval wargame campaign players, according to the...
True. Yes. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, like we mentioned last week, we're still at a point where the idea of publishing adventures was somewhere between hadn't occurred to them or obviously anathema to them. And the idea of the whole interesting, imaginative, creative part is DMs making their own dungeons, making their own campaign worlds. And it would seem offensive to step on a DM's toes about that. And of course, at least one person from the old days, at least Rob Kuntz, still maintains that in some of the things that he's written recently. So so you get rules, you get some changes to how characters work, spells and monsters and items.
So should we just page through this thing?
Well, pretty much. Okay, so the first, okay, so you got a couple of sections that kind of replicate, right? They kind of echo the three volumes in the original set, mm-hmm. which what we now are accustomed to, the separation. There's a player's book, there's a monster's book, and there's a DM's book. So the first section is basically stuff for players that might change that. And the top thing that occurs to me is you do get two new classes here, notably thieves.
Thieves, and I assume you're referring to paladins as the other one.
And paladins, right, which and sort paladins. Of shows up in a little footnote. The paladins are sort of like a one-paragraph footnote at one point.
it's very strange, yeah. I mean, right? How they're introduced is certainly very strange, right? Because they're kind of rolled in like, oh, let's talk about ability scores. Oh, by the way, if you have a really high charisma, you can be a paladin.
right. And you get this spell, and you get this spell, and you get this spell. That's it.
Yeah,
it's right. It's buried in the paragraph on how charisma changes. Okay, so let's, you know, the original question for these is like, what parts are good, right? Maybe we could focus on the mm-hmm. parts that are good. So, thieves, good. Do we want to use them, Paul?
Yeah, you're okay.
Okay, I feel like the concept is strong. Yeah. And I think if you have brand new players in a D&D and you put forward the basic four options of you can be a warrior, you can be a wizard, you can be a cleric, you can be a thief. There are a lot of players that very quickly embrace, yeah, I want to be a thief. The execution here, arguably underpowered, and also brings in a unique percentile-based skill system, which rankles a lot of us. So maybe I think the execution could have been done better. Maybe thieves could have been more able to succeed with their proficiencies at first level. But I think the concept of like you want a thief in the game, I'm totally down with that.
You know, so I'll relate, and I'm sure I've related this anecdote before on this show, but one of my favorite anecdotes about old school D&D, original edition D&D, is I can't even remember where I picked this up, but the story goes, at a convention, someone was running original, you know, old school white box D&D, gonna run a game of this, and a player came up and said, oh, that sounds amazing, I love Dungeons & Dragons, I want to play the original game, I want to be a thief. And the GM says, well, I'm sorry, actually, thieves aren't in this game. There are no thieves. And the player says, oh, man, I really wanted to be a thief. And the GM says, so steal something. Right? And I love that, just not only because it's just ridiculous, but also because like it embodies, I think, kind of the spirit of old school D&D, which is, you know, immersion and interacting with the environment over lots and lots of rules. Right? I don't need rules to be a thief, Dan. I could just go steal something.
Well, but can you backstab something? Because that's why I wanted to be a thief.
Yes, right? Don't you get a bonus for attacking from behind, so yes.
You don't sure get you double get. Damage. You don't get, no.
Don't
my,
get double
when damage. I say backstab, I want the double, triple damage. That's what I'm looking for.
Well, I'm just going to give you a funny side note. The word backstab is not in this book.
True, but there is the phrase by striking silently from behind. So, so yes, if you want to be not, I will henceforth say I want to be able to strikingly silent from behind. Silently from behind for double or triple damage.
Yeah. I mean, I get it, but like, okay, so. I think one of the interesting things about this book, sorry, I'm gonna broaden this discussion a little bit, so we're not just bickering about whether or not thieves are a good idea. I think before I had read this, I think the most interesting thing I heard about it, probably from you, Dan, was, well, it adds a lot of the stuff that moves from, that is clearly like the linkage between original D&D and first edition AD&D. And I think that's true, right? Like there's a lot of things that I am accustomed to that feel very traditional to me about first edition AD&D that appear here for the first time. And the funny thing is when I was running BX, when I first got into old school D&D, I was running a BX campaign, ran it by the book for a little bit, eventually decided I didn't like that, wanted to tune it. And I started house ruling stuff in, and splitting up race and class is the first thing I did, right? Okay, I want a race class split. The second thing I did is I really wanted rangers and paladins. And so I pulled them in. I found supplements that pull those in. I think Brave Halfling made some nice supplements on how to pull those into a BX context that worked really well. But so it's just interesting to me that this book is already like halfway there by adding paladins in.
Totally.
And not, but I'm surprised not rangers. When did, especially with like, especially when you consider the Tolkien influence, how come paladins came before rangers?
Well, that interesting question. I mean, rangers came up in a TSR magazine supplement. I think maybe just a couple months later, maybe a month or two later, someone had the first ranger expansion.
They don't get when do they show up officially in a TSR publication? Is it not until first edition AD&D?
Correct. And maybe the series of supplements that you see in the forward, maybe that's being filled in by the TSR publication that did run for about 7 issues. Yep. So maybe that counted at the time, but yeah, rangers weren't in a hardcover book until AD&D. I mean,
okay. So the interesting thing to me is, like, of all the subclasses, those are the two that I most want back, right? There's plenty, lots of other subclasses have appeared over the years, but those are the two that immediately jump out at me as feeling, I don't know if it's nostalgic or just fits into the setting. I like it. Now, the interesting thing is, I think when we've discussed this, like, if I compare it to, say, subclasses for magic user, I think you and I both agree, like, not really necessary. You can make an illusionist by simply taking a magic user and giving them a bunch of illusion stuff, right?
Paul, likewise, you want to be an illusionist? Cast an illusion.
Cast an illusion. There you go. Exactly. So, likewise, I think you've pointed out with the feat system that you've incorporated into the OED, that kind of takes the place of some of the fighter subclasses, right? You want to be a barbarian, take the berserker feat. You want to be a ranger, take you have a tracking feat? Do you have a
tracking feat? Yep, definitely, yep.
Yeah. Okay. Great. Right. So just by tuning some of those things, you can have that. Do you have a scouty light armored nimble?
No.
Interesting.
Answer is no on that.
That I feel like is the place where the thief starts to fit for me. Right. Like being lightly armored or no armored, being, you know, being more agile and less, you know, less hard hitting.
Yeah.
Right. I think it's weird. It's weird to me that in the modern editions of D&D, the thief has become like the major dealer of damage. Right.
I hear that.
Right. They're the glass cannon, if you will, of the, you know, class spectrum. Yeah. Right. They deal, you know, they're all about the sneak attack and dealing massive amounts of damage. So that's why I want to like pick on. Do I really need that for this? Is that the most important thing about a thief to me, is the ability to sneak up behind and deal a massive amount of damage? That almost sounds like assassin to me. I think for me, thief is more about mobility. It's moving around, right? Climbing, hiding, you know, scouting. Those are the things I want to see for a thief class. And some of those things we can get borderline into kind of ranger territory. You know, I'm okay with that class being more of, I like to use a bow. I like to wear light armor. I like to be unseen if possible so I can do scouting missions. That's what I'm looking for in the thief class, I think.
Such great points. Paul, we are currently on page 1.
Oh no!
Well, page 4, but it's the first page of content. So you know, viewers, check out our prior video. I think in season 1 on thieves, because this has been an ongoing little bit of a debate on the Wandering DMs channel the entire time that we've had it. So we're probably not going to entirely resolve it now. I love talking about it. So the next section is.
Let me just pick on one more thing about classes, though, because the other thing I find interesting about this book, right, is that druids appear in this book, but not as a playable class, which I find very interesting.
Yes. Druids appear on the monster list, monsters only, and then over the next couple of supplements, they transform into a playable character race, a class, sorry. Yeah.
I see them here on page 6, too, under the alignment spectrum. Give me a little taste. They're the first thing under neutrality.
Yeah, exactly. Because it's the first thing in the new monster list.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. All right, pushing on.
Yeah.
Should we talk about ability
scores? How many times have we seen that? Monster turns into player character.
Lots.
Okay, so the other thing Greyhawk does here, and again, just like Paul said, this is going to look a lot like AD&D. There's not a whole heck of a lot of difference. The original design, some of the original designers would actually say, really, if you use all the Greyhawk rules, you basically have AD&D right at that point in 1975. So you have significant changes to ability scores. I don't know if you want to pull up that red image there, Paul. So sure, they, where we had that's the red one, not the orange one. Sorry, I know it's very close. Sorry.
There, yep.
Okay. So here you see new tables for the... So this is just the pages for strength, right? And then you have a couple more pages as they modify how intelligence, wisdom, dexterity, charisma works. And this is where you get, where we had very, very simple modifications of in the original books of maybe you're shooting a bow and you either get +1 or -1 if you have very high or low dexterity, that's it. But here you get this very expansive table of strength, possibly changing your hit chances, your damage, it changes your encumbrance, doors opening. And in each of these cases, we're not going to go through all of them, but in each of these cases, the primary detail is stacked up at the high end. So like with this strength table, the majority of the bonuses only accrue at 16, 17, 18 strength. And that's true for all the ability scores here. So you exponentially get better armor with your dexterity right at the tippy top end of the dexterity range, same for constitution. And then of course here they also invent, just for strength, the extraordinary strength extra table, whereby if you specifically have 18, then you go roll percentile dice and you're on a brand new table to track that. So I gotta say, right, when I was a kid and I cracked open the AD&D Player's Handbook and I saw this on the first page in AD&D, I was so excited. I was so excited about, all these numbers, all these modifiers. I can learn all this stuff. I can use this for new fighters and stuff like that. My fighters will be so much more powerful. And I was really entranced by, I get why this is a publication. How do we feel about this nowadays, Paul?
It's interesting because I do feel like there's a bit of a disconnect every time if I run OD&D without Greyhawk and just play that with a group of players. Oftentimes a point of friction or a misunderstanding is how important the ability scores are. And I think in original D&D, they are basically unimportant almost completely, right? They do extremely little. And I think most people are very surprised by that, right? Most people are shocked. Apart from like an XP bonus, maybe, like why do I care if my wizard has an intelligence of 3? Is probably fine in OD&D, right?
Yeah, probably. I agree. Yeah. I agree.
I think that seems a little strange to most people who play the game. Like the very first thing you're asking me to do is roll these dice and assign these numbers. And what is the meaning of these numbers? Not much. And I think that's weird. So I like the instinct of like, you know what? The ability scores should do something. I don't mind that. And I don't mind tying them to specific classes. Oh, this ability score is important for this class, and that ability score is important for that class. Now, I think they went a little sideways here. Everything being very specific and rote for each ability score is weird. They're terribly imbalanced, right? We're already seeing that dexterity is clearly the most important attribute for anyone everywhere.
Good point.
Percentile die on top of the 18 strength. God, I just wish that had never happened.
I agree with that.
Yeah. So there's, I like the idea. I wish it could be a little more elegant. I would like to see a simple, and you see this in later editions, right? It just boils it down to a simple flat number that maybe does one thing, hopefully, the end.
By third edition. The third edition flattened it back out. Yep.
Yeah. By fifth edition, and you start looking at DMs, I was going to say DMs Guild. I can't remember the name of the online app everybody uses to track their character anymore.
D&D
D&D Beyond. There you go. Right.
Right.
You start to see in their character sheets, and maybe this is in the print character sheets as well these days, where the modifier is the main primary number you're looking at, and the actual number, the 3 to 18, is less important, which I think is fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah, which is kind of painful to me in a lot of ways. You know, in contrast, you know, it's interesting because, so I was running my Star Frontiers game Friday night, and we have a new player in the last couple of sessions who asked, you know, familiar with other games, asked that exact thing. And I like the fact that in that game, your ability score is just the thing you're rolling against. So if you have in that percentile game, 60% strength, and you got to force open a door, roll under 60. That's it. And it for what it's worth, that actually doesn't, the ability scores actually don't modify anything that you use skills for in any. So there's no separate modifier. It's that the ability score is the thing that you're rolling against at all times. And I got to say, I do kind of like the elegance of that, and the shift on the fifth edition character sheets is a little painful, because there's an alternate universe where it didn't have to be that way. But it is. You're right. That's what it is. Now, I will say, so for me, I think the things that I'm not going to like are places where we became more dependent on tables. So with the original D&D books, I like something that I can just hold in my head with a little bit of reading. So the original D&D books, I can hold the ability modifiers in my head. With this system, there is no way I can do that. So if for some reason someone puts on, I don't know, a strength increasing gloves, I've got to go to this page, and that's the only place I can find out what it does. Yep. And I have to be committed to going to these pages, looking at these tables, because there's no formula that will produce it. And that, I find that slows down the game, and that kind of slowing always irritates me. So I think that we do, you know, if you have to, we kind of like, you know, one option. We like what happens with Tom Moldvay and BX, right? So he has, you know, a somewhat more aggressive schedule, but it's all consistent. It's basically pretty much all consistent for all the different abilities. And I'm pretty sure I can, for most of them, I could recite by memory right now what they are, even though I technically don't run BX.
I mean, they're not, it's not, right. Yeah. He doesn't get 100% there, right? I was trying to remember this off the top of my head, right? Yes, there's like each of the scores does like one thing. Until you get to dexterity and charisma, and there's tables. Right. I'm like, you were almost there. You were almost there, Tom.
Yeah. Agreed.
Yeah.
So interesting. Not super thrilled with what I did there. Moving on.
Yeah. So let's see, another thing that jumps.
Yeah.
Another thing that jumped out at me here is, as we get into the tables, is the max level's gone way up, right?
There was never a limit.
Wizard. There was never a limit. Well, now they're being explicitly, right? Now there's actual charts, right? That's the thing. Like, I'm noticing here my magic user chart for, you know, bonuses and spells per level. It's going all the way up to 22.
Well, you know, the funny thing is, if anything, they've been slowed down, because so the original books have a formula for how to advance the table past what they printed. And it was super, super aggressive. Like every two levels, you get an extra spell and everything. And so here they've actually dialed it down a little bit. That progression.
OK,
I guess it's not super dissimilar, but it's.
You've also introduced higher level spells in this book, right? Like, I don't.
They have. Let's talk about that in a second. You're totally okay. Right. The thing is, on the page that you're looking at, Paul, which is page 10 on statistics, word argument classes, there's an enormous change. There's an enormous change that I don't have in a picture because it's just in the text. Is they changed the hit dice, right? They changed how hit dice work, and whereas in the original book, you had for every class, you had a table. All the hit dice were all D6. And the character classes, right, like the fighter would go D6 plus one and then 2D6 and 2D6 plus one and 3D6 and stuff like that. And here is where you get for the first time, fighters roll a D8 per level and wizards roll a D4 per level, right? This supplement here is the first time that appeared. I like the switch for the characters. And again, it's easier to remember, right? So now I don't have to try to look up that kind of complicated table in the original rules. I can just remember, you're a 6th level fighter, 68. That's your hit dice. You're a 10th level wizard, it's going to be 10d4. I know that. So this seems to me simpler, easy to remember, gives you a little flavor, gives some extra reason to use the polyhedral dice that didn't exist in the original rules, and kind of has this identification of each character class, like identifies with a particular die roll for their hit dice. This I like.
Yeah, I agree with all of that.
Yeah.
I mean, certainly the polyhedral dice weren't common, right, when the original game came out, and maybe by the time this book is being published, they're being adopted more and more, which is very interesting.
On the other hand, at the same time, they said if you're going to use this amendment, then you also have to change all the monster hit dice from D6 to D8 to match the fighters. And in my book, that's one of my like top mistakes. I think that's a hideous. Really? I know you don't entirely feel the same way. To me, that's a hideous mistake. Whereas before, you could just grab all your customary D6s, you could just steal them from your war game and roll fistfuls of D6s. Now this technically commits you to having to get a whole bunch of D8 just for the monsters. And that, I think, was an enormous mistake.
Is it just because of accessibility of dice, or because you don't like the monsters having as many hit points as a fighter?
Accessibility of dice.
Okay.
Yeah.
I feel like in this modern day, so many of us have a dice problem where we are literally swimming in too many polyhedral dice, that's a non-issue to me.
I'll accept your viewpoint. I think it's a.
I'm honestly more curious about the fact is a first level fighter intrinsically better than the average monster or not? Right.
That's kind of a side point. I don't think they're necessarily connected. If they're equal, great. If they're if they're 1 point on average off, whatever. But yeah, the mechanics of just accessing a bunch of dice is way more important.
Assuming your basic damage die is a D6, if your fighter is going up to a D8 hit points, that means that 25% of fighters can take more than one hit, right? That they cannot be killed with a single hit, which is very interesting, I think. That is a change. Again, assuming that your average... Now, I don't know this. Have we changed how much a longsword does or a average sword does?
We have. So, yes, a couple pages later, we get the damage done by weapon for the first time. So, I actually have that in the picture if you want to look at it with the... what is that, the yellow? I think that's going to be the yellow dot.
Gotcha. So, our swords are doing D8, so...
Yes.
It doesn't really matter. Interesting.
Yes. Now, so as of course Paul knows well, in the very first publication of original D&D, it didn't say anything about damage anywhere.
Yeah,
it never said what the damage is. And then on the reprint, they pasted in a little thing that said every hit is 1d6. So yeah, in the original books, every monster, every weapon, everything just does 1 6-sided die of damage. That's it. And so here in the supplement is the first time that you get a difference between different weapons. Now, on the one hand, and you know what? If you look at the first column, they're the same numbers we use today in 5th edition. So daggers a D4 and a longsword's a D8 and a spear's a D6. And these became canonical and they were sticky and they worked well and people were fundamentally happy with these. I like this. I like having a difference between the weapons. What I don't like is the two columns worth of man-sized opponents versus larger opponents. And of course, that was sticky through AD&D. They retained that in advanced D&D. I don't see the benefit to that. It makes so little difference in most cases. And again, in Tom Moldvay's BX, he just sliced out the second column. As of third edition, they just sliced out the second column. That's how I personally play. So for what it's worth, in my book, right, I circle this column, good, use this column here, cross it out, ignore that, please. And that's what I do with my own copy of Greyhawk.
I mean, you kind of glossed over the fact that just before that is the alternative combat system, where we also buy weapon type, modify armor class, right? Like, it, you get to this point, there's this chart on the table, on the I don't know, you probably don't have a picture of this, but there's a chart we get the tiniest text, like they clearly had to do something special to get a smaller font in there to fit all those numbers.
Particularly for the ranged weapons, so that's the weapon versus AC modifications, and that is the single most mathematically bungled thing that was ever written for D&D. I have that on my blog from a couple years ago, and that is the result of a chainmail chart being incorrectly translated to D&D, and the effect in many cases is exactly the exact opposite of what the intention was. Gary never play tested it. Was very consistent, never used it, never wanted to use it, never really looked at it, just churned out some numbers and never noticed that it was entirely, totally broken. And I invite any viewers to check out the details on my blog when that occurred to me a couple of years ago. That's the most broken table you're ever going to see in D&D.
That's funny. Dan, before we move on to out of player land, which I think maybe we already kind of have, the other thing I think that we forgot to talk about that I found interesting in this book is the multi-classing that gets slid into descriptions of races, right? Right? So is this the first book where we see half-elves? Is that right? Are half-elves in the original?
Yes. No. This is first.
No half-elves in the original. Yep. So it's just fascinating to me that you get this kind of, like, the dwarves get to be fighter thieves in the same way that elves were fighter magic users, and that they're splitting it up. And then, but not hobbits. Hobbits, according to this book, which my book actually says hobbits, which I'm very pleased about. Even in the 12th printing, they're still saying hobbits. Fascinating. Mm-hmm. Right. Hobbits are either fighters or thieves, but not both. So clearly different from dwarves, who are both fighters and thieves. Just fascinating.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah. And then half elves are just absolutely hilarious because you get delightfully, just completely contradictory information in here. There's a bit, I'm not finding it right now. There's a bit about how half elves cannot be clerics ever, except that sometimes they can. Which, there you go.
You're right. You're right. So on page 6, you're right. It does say there are no half-elf clerics, for in this regard, their human side prevails. And then 3 sentences later, half-elves may work up as high as the 4th level vicar clerically.
Yeah, if they have to have a 13 or more wisdom in order to become a cleric. But it's just such an awkward way of saying that.
Right.
Yes, like half-elves. Right. There are no half-elf clerics. However, half-elves with a wisdom of 13 or higher may become clerics. Like, wait, what? What? What is going on?
There's a lot of awkwardness in there. I feel to broadly generalize that, right? So, of course, multi-classing was in the original books with elves were automatically their fighters and their magic users. Here, they're basically saying, now that we have thieves on board, every race can be a thief, and they can mix and match with the other stuff they could already be. So, dwarves can be fighters and thieves, and of course, the elves, since they could be fighters and wizards, they could be fighters and thieves, or wizards and thieves, or thieves and fighters and wizards and thieves. And all of a sudden, you have a lot more text with all the different combinations that open up.
Yeah, and it seems like nobody took the moment to step back and go, wait a minute, now with 4 classes, the combinatorics of multiclassing is complicated, right? Instead, they just kind of sprinkled it in all over the place. I think this might also be the first place where we actually have the concept, again, under half-elves, of possibly you might have a character who's both a magic user and a cleric at the same time, which is fascinating. If they opt, all experience will be divided in equal proportions between fighting, magic use, and clericism. Right. We're talking about a triple class half-elf here.
You're right.
I just think it's so interesting that we've got these kind of weird multi-classing rules that are just slid in under the description of races, and good luck with that.
Yeah, and that's the primary thing they're talking about there, right? That's most of the text under races is dealing with these multi-classing combinatorics, plus the fact that the ability scores are tied in there, and you can get higher gradations if you have higher ability scores. So yeah, that's the majority of the text there about the racial types.
Yeah,
funny,
very interesting.
Just, you know, bear in mind again, some people think original D&D was races class, and it's definitely not. Right, that was a simplification made by Tom in BX.
Yep, for sure.
Okay.
We're running. You want to talk about spells? Dan, I don't think you've gotten into the. We've only maybe made it a third through this book.
Yeah, I know. This is what I'm telling you. Okay, so we got to talk about the spells. So they add new spells for both magic users and clerics, and in particular, they extend how many levels worth there is. So whereas, and if I just look at, you know, magic users or wizards nowadays, whereas originally they were levels 1 through 6 of your spells, now they add levels 7, 8, and 9, all new spells. Now, okay. So the problem here, you know, I mean, there are days when I say I don't want to use any of them, okay? And then the problem is that there's just a couple of super canonical spells that we inherently identify with D&D in this book. And it's like, if I don't have these, people aren't even going to think that I'm playing D&D. And in particular, Magic Missile. Magic Missile is invented in the Greyhawk supplement. It doesn't exist before that. The Shield spell. The web spell, right? I mean, to me, a wizard is like, is going to cast, they're the first two things I usually take. Magic Missile and a web at second level. And they appear on the list for the first time in Greyhawk. Mirror Image. Paul, like, whenever you're playing a wizard in one of my games, I'm expecting you to cast Mirror Image as one of the first things that happens. And that's invented for the first time in Greyhawk. Now, once you get that, past that, the spells, to my taste, get wonky or weird or limited use or hard to interpret or maybe even beat by another existing spell. So Rope Trick is in there. You know, you have Extension, which practically does nothing. You have 1, 2, 3 separate extension spells that like extend a spell by like a couple rounds or something like that, which seems like insane for a higher level spell. You have the series of monster summoning spells, 1 through 7, which to my mind is like not great design, because that's like, we have the monster tables, so here's a spell that just like reuses the monster tables. That was not great thematic design. It's just reusing something in the book. And then my main beef, you know,
I think one of the odd things about that too is that we already have the precedent for spells that scale with level, right? You have Fireball that gets more powerful the higher level you are when you cast it.
Totally.
And now we're going to split up the powers by level of spell. That seems weird.
Great point. Yeah. Great, great, great point. Totally agree with that. And then, you know, in the original books at the 6th level, you had these be all end all, you know, world-shaking spells. You can bring something back from the dead. There's a death spell that just like kills everything. There's Gaius that just enslaves somebody as long as you want. There's Control the Weather, right? Mm-hmm. What is there going to be past that? And so the attempt at making stuff beyond that at the 7th, 8th level seems unconvincing to me. And the main thing that happens here is there's a piece of text that says, oh, well, the spells at 7th, 8th, 9th level, there's no saving throws. for any of the spells. And I feel like, again, that's like, that feels, I don't know, cheesy. It feels not great design. It feels like clearly you just had to break the whole interaction of how we play D&D in order to justify the these higher level spells. That I'm, you know, and you know what? They weren't included in BX.
Yeah.
Right. So Moldvay and Cook didn't use them.
I agree with you here, and it's amusing to me that you're glossing over the cleric spell lists, although I think they have the same issues, right? There are some spells in the cleric spell list that I associate with D&D, right? Our Speak with Dead is in here. Silence 15-foot radius, and my favorite definition of silence, and when you read the spell, you know, you and I've had lots of conversations about the silence spell. When you read the description in Greyhawk, it makes sense, and it is not what everybody uses it for anymore, right?
You're right. You're right.
But again, do I need anything past the sixth level? No, not really. Or even the fifth level on cleric spells. Like, you know, do I need level six and seven here? No. Do I want the magic user's seventh, eighth, ninth level spells? No. In fact, I would even go so far as, do I need levels past, say, 12? Do I need wizards who are 13th, 14th, 15th, 16th, 20th, whatever level? No, the answer for me is no. I don't need. I prefer a leveling system where there is a maximum that is attainable and reasonable to reason about.
Interesting. You know, that's certainly not a change here. The original books established infinite levels of.
I understand that. It's easy to miss, though. It's easy to miss in those original books because the charts only go so high, and then there's like a sentence about, oh yeah, by the way, you can keep going. Which
An observation I had on my blog many years ago of like, if there's a picture and there's text and they say slightly different things, people always remember the picture. They never remember what the text said. That's just forever.
Yep.
Yeah.
So anyway, I think generally I'm in agreement with you here about the spells. I think that the higher level spells are a bit baroque.
Yeah.
Right? They're just
for my OED game, right? I do use those ones that are super identified. I do use Magic Missile and Shield and Mirror Image and Web and some of those ones at lower levels. I don't deal with the 7th, 8th, 9th level spells. I don't use Monster Summoning in my games. I mostly ignore the higher level ones for what it's worth. And boy, those cleric spells, they're all like the most difficult things in the game show up here. And I'm like, definitely hard pass on the new cleric spells. No, thank you.
No.
So, you know, you get the variant weapon damage. And then when you look at monsters, then you, again, if you're using variant weapon damage, you have to turn to these multiple pages and pages and pages where we give variant damage to all the monsters. They're really high amounts of damage, much higher than what they used to be. And now you're going to have to flip through multiple books to look at the monster stats in the old book plus the new damage stats in this one. I largely ignore those. They're complicated. They're really high amounts. This is the first book where you get a lot of monsters with this claw bite. You don't have one attack. You have three attacks, each of which is doing a tiny amount of damage. I don't think that was a great idea.
I'm going to speed ahead here. We got 10 minutes left.
Please.
As we get into the magic item charts, though, there are a lot of magic items in here that I love, right? There's like a lot of great magic items appear for the first time here. And the charts, they're just, this feels like D&D to me. So I love the magic items in this book.
Like what pops out is some of the ones that you're most fond of?
Oh, gosh. And part of it is just the quantity, right? You've got some classics in here. The Rod of Lordly Might is in here, right? What else is in here? The Figurines of Wondrous Power are in here. The Deck of Many Things, right? Like, there's some real classics.
True. Sphere of Annihilation gets added in here.
Sphere of Annihilation.
Yep, you're right. Paul, the poisonous cloak is in here for the first time.
Oh, great.
put on a cloak, instant death, no save. Which has happened to Paul, I will point out, when I was DMing at one point.
Dan delights. That's one of Dan's fondest DMing memories, I'm sure.
Put on the cloak, yes!
Now, we've talked about it before, but you know, the thing that gets expanded the most here are the miscellaneous magic items. So you have this pages and pages now of tables specifically of miscellaneous magic. So it's so many things to pop up and surprise and be unexpected and unknown to your players. One thing we talked about in the past is, yeah, go ahead.
I will say that miscellaneous magic items have always been my favorite, right? Like, I love the Book of Marvelous Magic. I love the weird magic items. Yeah, another sword with more pluses. Boring. Give me some crazy, you know, object that does unexpected things. I love that stuff.
I agree. You know, I totally agree. Now, the one thing that happens here that we have talked about in the past is that many of those miscellaneous magic items are cursed. And there was clearly a commitment here that any form of item now, every one of these miscellaneous magic items, whatever form you look at, there must be a cursed version of it. So now there's a cursed version of a crystal ball and a cursed version of medallion of ESP, cursed scarabs, cursed bags of holding, cursed elemental summoning. And I think about 30% of these miscellaneous magic item lists are now cursed items. Clearly you can see the design intent, right? Like, you don't know. You pick up a thing, it might be dangerous, it might be good, it might be bad. Yeah. You're not entirely sure.
Honestly, I feel like they went super overboard with this. I know we're not talking about this book, but in the Marvelous Magic book, there are so many entries that begin with, this object looks just like this other magic item in this same table, except, right? And then we get the cursed version. Like, gosh. Like, really, do your players know these items so well? Have they studied all the magic items so well that you need versions that are cursed, that look and operate just the same way as the real one?
Let me propose an alternate design strategy here. You could have come in and you said every item has a 10% chance of being cursed, and either reversing or scrambling the effect to be detrimental. Here's a couple of examples. Here's five or six examples. Bag of Devouring, Poisonous Cloak, Medallion of Thought Projection, Scarab of Death, whatever you want. On the one hand, I kind of feel bad about, you know, frowning on Gygax's burst of creativity to make all this stuff. And there's a whole bunch of these like classic cursed items. But they weren't really sticky design-wise. We don't usually play with lots and lots of cursed items in our current D&D games. It wasn't super viable. Maybe just a couple of examples and a general rule would have been better.
Honestly, my most memorable cursed item comes from our campaign that we played with our friend BJ, who was playing a paladin who ended up with cursed armor of arrow attraction. And I remember this mostly because he never knew. He had no idea that he was running around in armor of arrow attraction. And when he finally found out, well after the campaign was over, he was like, well, that's great. I love that item.
Yeah.
Right? Because that was his deal. Was he's the character with the best armor and the armor class and the highest hit points. And he was like, great. If I can make the arrows come at me instead of my friends, that's what I want.
Yeah, he was kind of doing that already. He's running out in front with the paladin trying to attract the arrows. Of course, you and I agree that having an item that is cursed that you can somehow pivot to your advantage is one of the best things that can happen in D&D. So I want some of that stuff. You know, Poisonous Cloak, maybe that wasn't the best one in the universe. But you know, it gives you some interesting spice.
Yeah.
Before we get done, we really ought to look at the monster list, Paul. I'm going to feel super bad if we don't look at the monster list. Okay. And I do have, maybe you could just briefly bring that up with the probably a blue dot, probably. Because what does happen here in Greyhawk is, again, you get some really canonical, fan favorite new monsters. And if in the basic books, the monsters were almost entirely Greek myth. to a large degree, almost entirely out of Pliny the Elder or something like that. And then here you start to get some new stuff. And in particular, Gary got his hands on like a bag of plastic toys, like half a dozen plastic toys, pulled out a couple of them, declared what they were going to be in, to use in his game. And so here, for the first time, you get bugbears, you get storm giants, liches. Liches didn't exist until the Greyhawk supplement. Harpies, lizard men. I know you were talking about doppelgangers in our last couple episodes, talking about mysteries, Paul. Beholders, right? I mean, they're on the cover, obviously.
Yeah, there's some great artwork in here too, right? Here's our right. bug. There's an owl bear, and there's our quote. What the label actually says: bugbear, ghoul, and friends. Here's your classic pumpkin-headed bugbear. That's great,
right? Isn't that great? There's a picture, right? Were-rats. I mean, what's your favorite lycanthrope? Probably were-rats, and they show up for the first time here, also depicted.
Yep.
On this a couple pages earlier there. So what would D&D be without were-rats or rust monsters? Golems. Yep. Golems get statistics for the first time here. So I feel like that's probably like a real high point for me is the new monsters that were really sticky, were really did become favorites, and really became like essential, I mean, I'm going to say IP here, like really, you know, mental space about what D&D is. This stuff was very successful.
Yeah. You know, before, I know we're kind of rushing, but before we run out of time, the last three pages of this book, The Underworld and Wilderness Adventures, is just three full pages with dense text of additional tricks and traps. And there's some delightful and some terrible and weird things in here, right? They're so odd. There's some classics, right? Okay, statues that come to life or whatever seems pretty standard, right? Treasure chests with false bottoms. Yes, we've seen that a million times. Mm-hmm. But also, weirdly, a box of animal crackers which spring to life. For example, a bear might dump a bowl of porridge on the player's head. A giant fox might demand a bunch of grapes or else he'll attack. There's a whole bunch of stuff. Like, what? What is this?
Right?
This is bizarre.
Right?
Gary clearly just went off the rails at the very end here. It's delightful and weird.
I agree. Is this the place where there's the giant bowling alley has always been stuck in my head? there's a hall of gambling where some great items are won, but where the stakes are large amounts of money or magic items and the games are fixed. Teach the players you can't expect to get something for nothing. And then there's also dissimilar monsters who will act in combination, such as a troll with a magic spear riding a purple worm. Or
I want that. A cloud giant riding a Tyrannosaurus Rex. Yes, please.
And then finally, because it's kind of escalating, finally it ends with Mars mounted upon Talus's shoulders. The deity, the god of war, mounted on a giant triple iron golem from Greek mythology. Okay.
That's great. Yeah. Yeah, and then you know, similar nature monsters. You've got the thing like the dragon that spits ochre jelly. Yes,
right.
What a dragon! Right? I've never. Right? This is all new to me. Like decades old content that I've never seen before that I now desperately want in my game.
Great. Yes. Great. I think that's you know, a lot of these books have like advice for the DM at the end, right? Is I think what we're accustomed to seeing in a lot of these, and then. There's this I guess from Gary, maybe with help from Rob, just this wild creative outburst of like, here's some crazy stuff you could possibly do in your dungeons. And apparently, remember, Gary didn't want to reveal any secrets. So this must all be stuff that actually happened to his players, and he has an entire other stock that we're not seeing of the stuff that the players haven't figured out. Isn't that nuts?
Amazing. That's amazing. Yep. Dan, we are definitely out of time. Final thoughts on the Greyhawk supplement.
Okay. I think we were right to make the call to dedicate one episode per supplement.
Yeah.
Is what I'm thinking. And I think in general for me, I think that, you know, adding stuff that adds to the game a monster or a magic item that appears like in one encounter and it's a surprise, and it doesn't entirely change the basis of how your campaign runs, is perfectly fine. Add some spice. It's a one-off thing like these tricks and traps. That's perfectly fine. The new spells, consider pick and choose. The ones at the start, and that's what we spent most of the time talking about today, that structurally change player-facing stuff, right? The monsters and the magic items is DM-controlled stuff behind the screen. You can handle that. The stuff that changes what the players directly interface with, you got to be really careful. So I'm not going to add every single class. I'm not going to use all these ability score modifiers and things like that. I'm going to be very, very selective about those kind of things. And the other thing is that I would prefer not to be locked into tables. So an adjustment from a table to a simple formula, like with the character hit dice, I'm all for it. A change from a simple ability score formula to a big table, that I don't want to play with anymore. So I do like things a little bit simpler. In some cases here, they got better. In some cases, they got worse.
Yeah. I mean, it's a, you know, of the supplements, I'll say this one's probably my favorite. This is probably my favorite of the supplements. And I don't mind a book that is a hodgepodge of here's a bazillion things that you maybe want or maybe don't. And I think there's like a long tradition of this, right? Frankly, isn't this what Unearthed Arcana is? Of just like, here's a bunch of random stuff. You could use it or not. I don't know, whatever, right? Like, that's what I feel like this is. And I think that's the way to make benefit out, or to get the most benefit out of this, is to really come at it with that razor of like, well, is this going to make my game better or worse? And I'll take the bits I like and axe the ones I don't.
Totally agree. You know, the legacy was almost all this stuff became core rules as of Advanced D&D First Edition later. So we might be, you know, in kind of this niche where we can look at it like that. I agree, as far as original D&D goes, that's the best way to consider using it. Totally.
Yep. Viewers, if you have opinions on the Greyhawk supplement or any details, because this book is packed full of stuff. Did we miss something? Did we gloss over and go too fast? Probably, because we only had an hour. some element, any bit of Greyhawk that you think is really exciting or interesting or terrible, leave us a comment in the YouTube video comments section. We'd love to hear from you. Maybe that will spurn off a new conversation for us down the road.
Definitely. And of course, remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us. We are on YouTube, Twitch, Facebook, GitHub, places like that. We have the handle Wandering DMs on all of the sites. So please polymorph that like button to something totally different.
If you prefer to listen to our show in audio-only podcast format, you can do so. Those podcasts are available on our website at wanderingdms.com. You can also find us through various podcast carriers like iTunes and Spotify. If you're listening to this show on one of those sites right now, and it offers the ability to do so, please rate and review our show. That helps other users of that site find us, and we really appreciate it.
We really do. And huge thanks to our patrons who support the show. If you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. You'll see our different tiers. And just like Paul said at the top of the hour, every single tier gets you access to our private Discord server where the conversation continues round the clock. And we will be there in about 10 minutes or so to continue the very dense conversation, because we have more things we want to say. And we also want to hear what you have to say. So please join us in our live after chat on Discord in just a couple minutes. Also, big thanks to our viewers for being a little bit of a technical issue when we were live here today, going towards YouTube. So hopefully that will be smoothed out in the future. We will be back, both of us back next week, right, Paul?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, I'll be wandering off to TotalCon this coming weekend. That's a gaming convention here in Marlborough, Massachusetts. But I should be back in time on Sunday afternoon to be in the show and maybe have some interesting post-con thoughts.
Great. I will definitely be looking for that myself. So, and again, please join us in the after chat in about 10 minutes for more chat about the Greyhawk, possibly other supplements from original D&D. And don't forget, we are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. So please, we hope you'll join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.